You're listening to Midori House first broadcast on the 9th of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
It was that moment when the person asking to sit in the most respected seat in our country imitated a disabled reporter. It kind of broke my heart.
It's Hollywood versus Donald Trump. As an awards ceremony gets political, we ask whether celebrities have a duty to speak out and whether the country benefits as a result. And speaking of the president-elect, the UK's top diplomat met with Trump's inner circle today at Trump Tower. Will pretend to be a fly on that gilded wall. Plus Barack Obama's legacy and the ups and downs of Italian politics. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the journalist Mary Dzhevsky, a columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and Michael Binion, a foreign affairs specialist at The Times here in London. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to kick off the show high up in an office at Trump Tower. Boris Johnson, the British Foreign Minister, met with Donald Trump's top advisers today as Team Trump prepares to enter the White House. It was the first official meeting between Trump's camp and the UK government. Michael, what do you think that Boris could hope to get out of this?
I think he'd hope for a reassertion that Britain matters to America and that Trump thinks that whatever the outcome of Brexit, Britain will still play an important role as America's partner. He wants some kind of reassurance that America isn't going to just turn its back on Europe in general and that it will remain engaged in NATO and that Trump will follow the sort of common accepted policy of collective responsibility, particularly vis-a-vis the Russians.
Because on the issue of Russia, there seems to be a difference of opinion between what the UK government has been saying recently and what now Mr. Trump is saying. Mr. Trump is saying anyone would be a fool not to want to cozy up with the Russians, to make friends with them, to have them on your side. But here in London, I think maybe it's just that greater proximity to what's going on in Syria. The feeling here is that the Russians have not been helpful, have not been good, and have not done the right or humanitarian thing in recent months.
Well, I think that Britain is talking with two tongues in this one. The Turkey-Russia deal has effectively ended the main fighting in Syria. The West has been a very, very reluctant observer of this. The fact is that the West was not there, was not on the ground, did not contribute to any meaningful ceasefire. The Turks bit their tongue. They did what they didn't want to do. They made a deal with Russia. And the fighting, at least in Aleppo, has ended. The West has been very mealy-mouthed about this. But they see a pattern of Russian aggression, Russian swagger throughout the Middle East and Ukraine and where they think adventurism around the world. Now, that is certainly not the view of Donald Trump. Donald Trump thinks that he has the understanding of Putin and can do a deal. Britain and various other countries think Mr. Trump is naive, that he's been bamboozled by the Russians, and that he's actually refusing to accept the reality of Russian intervention in the election. We'll see who's right. I think the truth lies somewhere between the two.
Now, Mary, before the election, and really up to that very minute that the vote started to come in, there was a feeling that Mr. Trump was not going to be the president. And there are many people within the Conservative Party who had spoken out against him and certainly some of his more outlandish statements. So is there some repairing to be done before we can even get this relation going? Because we know that in the first instance, Mr. Trump turned to the opposition politician Nigel Farage here in the UK as his friend, not to Theresa May.
I think there's a huge amount of repair work to be done. And I think that's one reason, obviously, why Boris Johnson has been sent really on what looks like an emergency mission. It was also said just before he went, it was disclosed that before Christmas, I think, Theresa May had sent her two closest aides on a sort of clandestine mission to meet members of Trump's team. Not Trump himself, but members of the team. Now, Now, both of those things suggest to me that Britain is absolutely in chaos as far as its America policy is concerned, and that in some ways, you know, the way we do diplomacy tends to be formal. We know how it works. We go through established channels. And when those, for some reason, don't work, I think Britain tends to find it very difficult. And so when you have Trump elected against what your ambassador apparently advised quite confidently, sitting in Washington, and against the feeling of the governing party in the UK, what do you do? Then you had the president-elect who said, well, you know, he really thought that his mate Nigel Farage would make a good ambassador for the UK to Washington. And, you know, there is a sense in which he might have been right about that. But, of course, it undercuts everything that really the British government and, you know, the established way of doing things. So, yes, I think there's a huge amount of catch-up and repair work to be done. And on the one hand, you could say that Boris Johnson is just the guy to do it. On the other hand, although he sort of acts and, you know, in a way, the whole atmosphere surrounding Boris is quite similar, so it seems, from this side of the Atlantic, to that surrounding Donald Trump. They ought to get on. But so far as we look at the first reports of what's been happening at Trump Tower, it doesn't look that promising.
Well, frank and honest is always, when people say that about a conversation, you know that they had a bit of a bust up. And I imagine there are lots of topics here, Michael, as you said, because if you look at any of these issues, you know, Mr. Trump says, you know, he's happy to have a nuclear arms race. That would not be in the interests of the UK. You know, he wants to rattle the cage of China. Well, this government has spent so much time trying to build bridges with China and make friends with it. He says, you know, that he will walk away from NATO members who don't put up the cash. The UK is concerned about defending our eastern flank. You know, it's quite good in one way that Theresa May and, you know, and our foreign secretary want to make friends with the Americans. But in the end, it's not going to be a very comfortable 4 years, is it? Because one, you have to play catch up, Mr. Trump, all the time, because you don't know what he's going to say and what he wants to do. And two, his ambitions are not the same as the UK government's anymore.
I think it's going to be an extremely difficult 4 years. It depends really to what degree Boris Johnson got into substance. I think he probably didn't talk about China policy in detail. You're right. On all the issues that you mentioned, there is a real disagreement between what Britain thinks is advisable or possible and what Trump seems to think he wants to do. And if Boris Johnson got into all those issues, then there would have been frank and honest exchanges. In other words, there would have been plain disagreement. I don't think Boris went that far. I don't think he had time, and I don't think it would be very profitable to do so. But if he had a sort of disagreement, even on the surface, that isn't a terribly good signal of what may come in the future. But I have to say, I don't think Britain is faring any worse than any other country. I mean, I think Germany is even more disconcerted by the Trump victory, and most of Europe doesn't really know what to make of him, nor does most of America yet. We'll just have to see whether diplomacy by tweet turns into a more coherent kind of diplomacy, or at least government by sort of rational process.
I think there's one other thing that you can add to that, in a way. Donald Trump comes with an electoral mandate, basically to change American foreign policy, to change it on Syria, to change it especially on Russia. Now, the problem, especially for the UK, and to a lesser extent in Europe, where there are elections this year, Theresa May became Prime Minister without an election. She stands for continuity with the government, and we have no pretext, and she has no mandate for changing the policy that's been in existence for most of the Obama presidency, when we were mostly on the same page with the United States. Now, how do you change that if you want to regard the US as your chief ally and you've got no mandate to change your policy? I mean, I've been sort of watching for the small print to see how far the British are trying, as it were, to edge a little bit closer to how American policy may look. But they've hardly started yet.
And she hasn't got time to rethink all these issues. She, you know, the Brits are going to be focused on Brexit nonstop over the coming years. So she doesn't got, you know, she has no time to be out there trying to campaign for, you know, peace in the Middle East, and she's certainly not going to be willing to move our embassy to Jerusalem to kind of back up the Americans, is she?
No, I don't think she is at all. And I don't think, actually, Donald Trump's going to be very focused on this either. I mean, he's made blanket statements of 100% support for Israel and, indeed, as you say, moving the embassy to Jerusalem. But actually, this is pretty far down on his agenda. He doesn't think he was elected to do American foreign policy. He was elected to shake up America, make America great at home, especially. He was elected to get jobs out to those Rust Belt areas, which is where his voters are, to abolish Obamacare. He's already talked about, you know, on the first day doing something about that. He's entirely domestically focused. He knows he's got to do a bit about foreign policy. Well, we'll do a deal here or a deal there, maybe a deal with Putin on Syria or something like that. But that's not his priority at the moment. And to be honest, neither is it Theresa May's priority. Theresa May has very little foreign experience. The only foreign issue that she's having to deal with, and in fact which is completely engulfing her government, is that of Brexit. And beyond that, Britain doesn't really have much of a vision of what else it wants to do.
We're going to have to move on. But it is, I find it slightly entertaining that we know that the personal relationships that have existed between American presidents and British prime ministers before, you know, a round of golf here and there, you know, that kind of keep the bonhomie going. But just before we move on, Mary, here we have somebody, you have a sense, I know that the Brits are painting themselves as, she's rethinking Britain, she's going to shake things up. But in comparison, it's like a rather nice afternoon tea party when suddenly a rather kind of like loud, bombastic, annoying guest arrives and everyone's holding their breath, hoping he might leave. She has nothing in common with a man who talks about, you know, grabbing women's genitalia, having, you know, his way with them, you know, who mocks the disabled, as we're going to come to in a minute. You know, there's going to be no kind of, you know, hey, why don't we spend the weekend together between those two, is there?
Well, this is probably the great defence of rather more formal relations. So maybe that's where they should leave everything and forget about the Reagan-Thatcher loving.
Well, we're going to shift gears a little bit and look at the legacy now of America's current president, Barack Obama. Michael, I think what's interesting is, you know, that many people, you know, like the man Barack Obama and think that he's done many good things, and yeah, and in comparison with what we see coming around the corner, see a man who is, you know, full of dignity and grace and calm, but he had many failings as well, and maybe those are slightly forgotten sometimes by the liberal in the centre. What's your judgment of him and his presidencies?
Well, you put your finger on it. What he is going to be remembered for is the sense of dignity, grace, and having brought a sense of real commitment to the office of president, and especially the commitment of his wife, who is immensely popular, who is a role model for very many people. And although Obama very wisely, I think, didn't get plunged into the race issue and was deliberately very, very aloof from the whole question of the rather tense relations between, well, particularly black-white relations in America, I think Obama's wife, Michelle, has been such a visible symbol of humanity and of compassion that has said things even though she hasn't had to articulate them. When it comes to actual achievements, you're quite right. There are some pretty big areas where not much has happened. But the problem with poor Obama is that he was completely stymied at every stage by Congress, who in the end had a sort of kamikaze type of policy that whatever the White House proposed, even if they agreed with it, they would shoot down, namely the Republican majority would shoot it down, because it came from a Democrat. And as a result, all he could do in the end was he could get Obamacare through, which they're now promising to dismantle, and he has a number of foreign policy achievements which the Republicans don't like at all, namely the Iran agreement and the deal with Cuba, the fact that he's opened up to Cuba. Now, whether both of these can survive, I'm not sure. But to be fair to him, Obama did what he was elected to do. And he was elected to stay out of foreign conflicts. All those who say Obama should have intervened in Syria, he should have been more assertive of American interests around the world, that's not what people elected him for. They elected him to get out of Iraq, to get out of Afghanistan, and not get entangled elsewhere abroad.
Mary, what's interesting, he came into power with unemployment at 10%, it's down at 4.7%, with the world looking as though it was on the abyss of an absolute global meltdown that would not be recovered from in a generation. He saved the American car industry. He has done a lot for the economy of that country. But the strange thing is the same here almost with David Cameron or with many other politicians. It's not enough anymore, is it? Unless you feel it in your pocket, that's the strange thing. He has a good economic legacy, but people don't give him any credit for that, really.
Yes, and I think there's a distinction here between Bill Clinton, who also had an excellent economic legacy, where I think people did feel it in their pocket, and Obama, where obviously they don't, because, you know, this appears to be one of the main reasons behind the election of Donald Trump, that there was a large group of people, as in the UK over Brexit, who felt left behind by the economic priorities. And I think maybe you can say that Obama was successful on the sort of macroeconomic level, but when it came down to the micro, maybe his attention was elsewhere, or maybe that's, you know, there were just other things that he was doing, that the overall statistics looked good, but then there were a lot of winners and losers. I tend to be maybe even kinder towards Obama's general legacy than Michael's been, because I think that already he's being regarded a bit more kindly than he has been over the last sort of 2-3 years. And I think both in domestic and in foreign policy, and not just because of the person who's taking over from him, but I think that Obama, by disengaging from foreign wars, by as it were, accepting that the United States had to be part of a more collegiate approach to dealing with other countries, I think that he's preparing the United States for what is going to come, when the United States is not necessarily going to be the most powerful or the most wealthy country in the world. And I also think that, at least in terms of foreign policy, certainly not domestic policy, there will be a degree of continuity between Obama and Trump, because Trump also has said that he's not going to be an interventionist.
We're going to move on now to the issue of Brexit. On Sunday, Theresa May gave her first televised interview of the year. And many people who watched that interview, Michael, came away with the feeling that she was saying there was going to be what we call here in the UK a hard Brexit. She was not going to have anything to do with the single market. She saw it as over because that was the only way of ensuring that we would have full control of anything to do with migration. Now, those stories were run by the press today, and you know, then she's in a panic today. She's making a speech to the Charities Commission. She's seen the pound drop against the euro and the dollar yet again, a 10-week low. And suddenly she said, oh, no, that's not what I meant. Maybe it's not going to be a hard Brexit. She doesn't like the terms hard and soft Brexit. She doesn't like to reveal her hand. You know, you're a newspaper man. You sit in a conference with your other editors. Are people beginning to weary of this at your paper, this feeling that, you know, she just doesn't seem to want to give any guidance to the British public?
They certainly are, and I think the British public is thinking the same as well. I think this idea of not revealing your hand is beginning to look as though you have no hand to reveal. People are beginning to say it's not clever tactics, it's simply trying to disguise a vacuous policy that is simply playing it from day to day as how it appears to be. The problem is she's still having to reconcile different feuding factions within her party. There are those who are out and out enemies of anything European, and she's put them all in one bunch and said, you negotiate Brexit. Well, they haven't come up with any viable, visible plan yet. There are the others in the Conservative Party who still resent the fact that Britain voted to leave the European Union and somehow want to try to modify that process. And she's caught in the middle. She also doesn't really have any other grand vision, because she knows that in the end, because it's such a momentous step, her legacy will be judged entirely on what kind of deal she secures with the Europeans. So she is Brexit or nothing. In other words, there's no other policy, no other big idea coming from her. That's why the papers are focusing entirely on what she says on this. She is saying very little, I think partly because the policy hasn't been formed, partly because there are massive disagreements as to what the actual aim should be, and partly because Theresa May herself does not like to hear contrary views. We've seen that in a number of occasions. She likes to hear an echo of what she thinks and nothing more.
And Michael, just tell me, I'm just fascinated how, you know, so your newspaper, you're a part of a stable of newspapers, were allowed to decide which way they would go on the vote, and the Times said we should remain in the UK, and it didn't go the way they wanted. You had lots of question marks against the European Union. And now as you look at this story unfolding, and you know, your paper is you know, famous for covering well the business community and many others, but what's the feeling, do you think that she could be persuaded to go for a less hard Brexit, or do you think that she in the end is going to be carried along by what she thinks the voters want?
Well, it depends really on what the other members of the European Union want as well. She will only be persuaded to go along with some less, quote, hard Brexit if she can get some fairly watertight deal on limiting immigration. Free movement of labour is the one thing that absolutely gets up her nose. She has been a very hardline Home Secretary who has tried to crack down again and again and again on immigration. And it is a bee in her bonnet, immigration. And on that, she's going to give no quarter at all. And that's why it appears she's favouring immigration control over access to the free market. But as you say, most of the people in the business community think that we need some form of immigration. We also need access to the market. How she reconciles all that with her own beliefs is completely unclear.
Mary, what's your judgment on Theresa May at this point and these very mixed signals that she's giving out? Do you think that she is beginning to lose the lustre that she had only a few weeks ago?
Well, I'll commit the crime of all columnists who have a platform in saying that before Christmas, before it became the sort of flavour of the new year to say that Theresa May might be in difficulty, I actually wrote a column that was very, very critical of her. I asked really whether she was equal to the task ahead. And I think that one of the initial problems is that she actually had one of the easiest rides to the post of Prime Minister of almost anybody in recent years, because she wasn't elected. She didn't have to defend her policies. She came to the position almost by default. And I think now we're seeing in some ways the she may have been a very good, or at least a very long-serving Home Secretary, but that's not the same as being Prime Minister. And personally, I think she made a colossal mistake in not immediately, she got the job practically, of invoking Article 50 and making clear that, as she said, Brexit means Brexit, because we've now had what looks like, you know, the best part of 6 months of complete drift, and we're sitting around waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on what is actually a technicality in terms of whether this is going to happen or not. And it's not until the end of March that Theresa May says that she's actually going to make this, which everybody accepts was given the green light by the referendum result. You know, it'll be sort of three quarters of a year between that actual vote and invoking Article 50. And I don't think that reflects well on the Prime Minister.
It doesn't reflect well on the poor country either. But anyway, we move on now because we're going to go to Italy, where the populist Five Star Movement has voted to join the most pro-Europe group of the European Parliament. In a poll, more than 40,000 Five Star members, that's 78.5%, backed the party's joining the centrist alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe. Now, Michael, we should explain that here in the UK, this story is being touted as a story against Mr. Farage and his party because they're going to lose a load of cash. And some people are saying that Beppe Grillo has just moved his party's alliance from a very anti-European group to a pro-Europe group because he wants to do well in upcoming elections, and this is a way of him looking a little bit more kind of voter-friendly. What's your reading of Mr. Grillo's manoeuvrings?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that that is one of the reasons why he's moved it, because most people in Italy think that Italy should remain a member of the EU, even though they're increasingly critical of the euro and the way the euro is working sometimes against Italy's own economic interests. But I think there's a more pragmatic reason why he broke the alliance with UKIP, and that is this party, United Kingdom Independence Party, has effectively voted itself out of office because they've achieved what it was they were set up to do, which is namely get Britain out of the European Union. We're not out of it yet, but that's only a question of time. And therefore, when Britain is out of the European Union, the United Kingdom Independence Party will no longer have any seats in the Parliament, and therefore the Five Star Movement will be left high and dry on its own in any case. So he might as well...
I think that's true, but I think there's another very interesting aspect to this too, which is that it's really shown up the Five Star Movement that we all look at as being sort of ultra-rebellious, the anti-establishment, as being essentially, through its members, pro-European Union. And of all the sort of forecast that Brexit would lead to a chain reaction across Europe, all the opinion polls that I've seen have actually suggested the opposite since then, that it's actually encouraged people to stand more by the status quo with the European Union.
Certainly the case in Denmark, that was also true, yes.
Now, we haven't got much time left, but we're going to play you a tiny clip. This is Meryl Streep yesterday at the Golden Globes.
There was one performance this year that stunned me. It sank its hooks in my heart, not because it was good, but it was effective and it did its job. It made its intended audience laugh and show their teeth. It was that moment when the person asking to sit in the most respected seat in our country imitated a disabled reporter. It kind of broke my heart when I saw it, and I still can't get it out of my head because it wasn't in a movie. It was real life.
Well, Meryl Streep, who was, of course, a Democrat supporter, but speaking from the heart there, Michael, and often when celebrities talk about politics, it doesn't go down very well, but do you think she was right to make a call out on this occasion?
Well, she was certainly entitled to say what she thought, and clearly she was deeply moved and very angry about it. I'm not sure that this is actually the right platform for her to do that. You could argue that celebrities or personalities should use every opportunity given to say what they think, and that they're not just pretty faces or voices or actresses or, you know, people who are just there in films. They are real live people with political views of their own. On the other hand, I just feel we don't really want these film occasions to become yet more kind of places where politics is reproduced.
Well, I think lots of people had a swipe, Mary, at Mr. Trump during this event. And what's interesting, you know, well, Trump is already, you know, back on Twitter, you know, she's an overrated actress and, you know, hitting at her. And he also denies that he imitated this gentleman. And there's the clip being played nonstop now on TV. And he did imitate this gentleman. So in a way, I think maybe she did the right thing, because it does point out the fact yet again that he just doesn't tell the truth about these things.
I think actually I'm not sure how significant, although you know, you'd like to believe that's true. I'm not sure that is true. Whether Hollywood actors should use their platform, I don't see why not. But the thing is that they are quite a homogeneous lot,
Because what's interesting is they're not homogeneous, and because, you know, they're gay and Jewish and black and white. And in a way, I think, like the Brexit vote, the people who voted for Remain, who like multiculturalism and like, you know, that's what they're trying to hold on to.
No, absolutely. And so you're talking, if you like, about, you know, a certain, as we might now say in the UK, with a degree of pride, even an intellectual cosmopolitan elite. But we've, you know, this isn't the first time we've seen this. We've seen American sportsmen using their platform when they get medals to make political points. We've seen half of Hollywood, as it seemed at one point, being out in Darfur protesting at what was going on there. So I don't have any problems with them doing it. That's fine for them to use their platform. And I don't have any problem at all with Donald Trump responding on Twitter.
Well, there you go. Michael, it just feels like the next few years, it's just going to be a time of more outspoken politics on both sides.
Absolutely. Oh, people are going to be firing off all the time. And it makes for lively journalism. I mean, it keeps us in business.
Can you remember there was a time here in Britain when they said when Tony Blair was Prime Minister that the old left and right was gone around the world forever, that we were all going to be centrist and we were all exactly the same. No difference in policies or anything. Well, that's all over. Mary Jajewski and Michael Binion, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. It is all we have time for today. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Gaia Lutz and also by Elisa Mare. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next, then at 1900 hours is Robert Bound with The Culture Show. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for joining us and goodbye.